Hello and welcome to Fresh Dialogues. I'm Alison Van Diggelen. Last week, as demonstrations and outrage continued across America, I received a request that made me very nervous. I was invited to join a live BBC World Service programme to discuss the view from California. I felt ill-equipped to contribute anything valuable to the dialogue. This is a challenging time to opine on the tinderbox that is America, particularly if you're a white immigrant. But I did my homework, listened and read widely. I can't claim to have all the answers. Who does? But in preparing for the programme, I grew from feeling tongue-tied and unworthy to fired up about speaking out. How, you might ask? My research taught me three important things. More on that shortly. Tuesday's BBC programme began by discussing Trump's executive order introducing police reforms. Then we listened to the insightful perspective of Philip McHarris. A researcher at Yale University, McHarris is a vocal member of the Community Resource Hub for Safety and Accountability. He makes some excellent points about the need to prioritise education and economic opportunity for the black community and has written a provocative New York Times opinion piece that concludes, quote, "We need to reimagine public safety in ways that shrink and eventually abolish police." I agree with his call to reimagine public safety, but I don't think abolishing police and prisons will ever be a wise idea. Here's Philip McHarris, followed by the BBC's Jamie Robertson.
Data shows that there's no clear correlations between reductions in what's called crime, including violent crime. Actually, when you look at the data, 95% of arrests are not for anything even involving violence. And so police are largely arresting people and putting people in jail and ruining lives and ruining communities when that is not. Oftentimes people need resources. People need resources and opportunities and not a prison cell and policing.
You talk about defunding the police. What does this mean?
Defunding the police means substantially shifting resources away from policing in order to do two things. One is to get at the underlying causes of violence, harm, and conflict, which is not having quality schools, employment options, housing, health care. And what we know is that when we look across this country, the communities that are the safest, they don't have the most police, they have the most resources. And so because of specific decisions and political inaction, housing policies that, you know, date back to the 40s and 50s have created legacies of racial and economic inequality, people often are forced and compelled into survival economies, which are then criminalized. And because of the hyper-criminalization all across this country, what we see is that police have the license and the authority to engage in contact with people, which then paves the way for police violence. And so the first step is getting at the preventative aspect, which is funding social community resources and institutions. The other side is developing alternative emergency response systems where police who have guns and a badge and license to kill with immunity are not showing up when someone might need a wellness check or someone might need a mental health crisis intervention or domestic violence support.
That's Philip McHarris from Yale University. Alison, this idea of defunding the police, it's got a bit of traction in Seattle. Anywhere else particularly? I mean, in Minneapolis as well. Anywhere else particularly where people are beginning to think about this seriously, about sort of withdrawing the police and replacing areas of police enforcement with, well, basically social welfare, social workers, people who get more sort of involved in the community?
There is support for this defunding police potentially and looking at the root causes. I think the fact is we all have biases. It's what we do with it and how we manage our first impulses. And the police force really needs to build new protocols and new partnerships, as Philip said, with social workers and psychologists. It needs to invest more in anger management and de-escalating violence rather than inciting violence. And perhaps making Malcolm Gladwell's book, Talking to Strangers, perhaps it should be mandatory for police officers. This pandemic has exacerbated this tinderbox of despair and rage in America. And perhaps America also needs to face its horrific history of slavery, because that legacy continues today. And perhaps we need to borrow practices from South Africa and Rwanda and hold truth and reconciliation hearings and criminalize and not tolerate any white supremacy actions, especially from our political leaders.
this has been a huge wake-up call, and I think it's going to precipitate certainly some examination of the way things are, and we can all just hope that real change will happen.
You can continue listening to our conversation at the BBC's Business Matters podcast, starting at around 7 minutes 38. So now, here are the three things I learned in research. First, speak out. As influential psychologist and author Adam Grant said, just as sexism is not only a woman's issue, racism is not only a black issue. In social movements, research has repeatedly shown that when majority groups stay quiet, they inadvertently license the oppression of the marginalized groups. So, no matter who you are or where you're from, this is the right time for speaking out against injustice and inequality. It's also a time for mindful listening, reading purposefully, and amplifying the voices of the black community. Number two, violence won't help progress. Barack Obama wrote a practical summary of his perspective on Medium. This part resonated with me. He wrote, "Let's not excuse violence or rationalize it or participate in it. If we want our criminal justice system and American society at large to operate on a higher ethical code, then we have to model that code ourselves." If you think about it, it's a version of Michelle Obama's powerful mantra, "When they go low, we go high." She elaborated on what she meant. "Going high doesn't mean you don't feel the hurt or you're not entitled to an emotion," she said. "It means that your response has to reflect the solution. It shouldn't come from a place of anger or vengefulness. Anger may feel good in the moment, but it's not going to move the ball forward." And lastly, number three, champion what works. You don't need me to tell you the United States has a horrific history of slavery, but it's not the only country that's ever dealt with systemic racism. Think about the last century of German and Rwandan history. And in South Africa, racism wasn't just systemic during the apartheid era. It was an integral part of the constitution and the law of the land. Many people predicted a bloodbath when apartheid ended, but instead, Nelson Mandela helped to make a peaceful transition. The country's Truth and Reconciliation hearings were an integral part of that. My fellow BBC contributor Barrett Holmes-Pittner writes eloquently about what we can learn from other countries and says, "Rwanda, Germany and South Africa have reckoned with their troubled past to make a better future, but America has long preferred to ignore the past and proclaim the inevitability of progress. America today must define and confront the original sin of slavery," he writes. Like Pittner, I'm keen to see a truth and reconciliation movement growing in the United States. Meanwhile, I'll continue to follow the commentary and insights from the Obamas, Van Jones, Kamala Harris, and many others. And I'll seek out insightful perspectives worth reading like Anne Applebaum's, and look for podcasts worth listening to like Rennie Addo Lodge's podcast about race. Thanks for joining us on Fresh Dialogues, and I look forward to hearing your perspective. I'm curious to know what you think about this crisis and what gives you hope.